seemed like I hadn't, we hadn't been up here very much over the summer, but now we're able to come normal schedule. And the sun really looked beautiful when it came out. When did it come out up here? Maybe yesterday, or it's a little bit on Thursday down where we were. And we had the opportunity and privilege to have somebody who was a refugee from North Carolina, somewhere near Spruce Pine, I think, at one of the places that got wiped out. He didn't personally get wiped out, but he had to chainsaw his way out of his driveway and so forth. And it's just everything was, I got that firsthand description of some of the mess and just the difficulty getting supplies or food or whatever. He was on his way up here to Pennsylvania and spent the night with us on Wednesday evening. But yeah, what a mess. All right. Welcome to our guests. It's nice to have some visitors. All right. Well, when I was at university a few years ago, I say a few, it's been more than a few, I guess, there was a musical group named after a couple of jazz musicians, and one guy named Pink and one guy named Floyd. And they came out with an album while I was in in college called Far Side of the Moon. This was some of the cover art here. And one song on Far Side of the Moon was called Us and Them. Or for those of us that might remember that, it was more like us, you know, about seven times, and them. And it was a hit for them. But the song was Us and Them. And here's some lyrics from Us and Them. Us and them, after all, we're only ordinary men, me and you. God only knows it's not what we would choose to do. And then the bridge or chorus comes out. Forward, he cried from the rear, and the front rank died. And the general sat, and the lines on the map moved from side to side. So the first verse talks about how, when it comes to war, individual people don't really matter. It's lines on a map. It's send the front lines in. We think how horrible that is, but you know it's always been that way. Remember, David did the same thing with Uriah, right? It's been that way for a long time. And I won't go into the other verses, but the second verse is how how we treat as humans, how we treat people that are different from us, or that we think are different, and we don't always treat them well. Third verse is about the typical attitudes we have about people that are really down and out. Do we help, not help, whatever, how we view them. But these lyrics in the song, and I'm not trying to, you know, promote the song or anything, but the lyrics talk about the way we are as humans. And I think they do a pretty good job of that. And it's no better now than it was 51 years ago when the song came out. There, that's how long it's been since I was in college. In fact, some people would say that it's worse now than it was then. And that's just the way it is. It's the way our world is. And when I think of Us and Them, I like this editorial cartoon. This is from The Week. And it illustrates that even the world's leaders sometimes want to draw lines and separate, you know, somebody. Watch where I do my gestures here. But watch, you know, who we want to divide. We want to divide people for our own purposes. One country wants to do that, another country wants to do that, or we want to do it within our own countries. Why did I pick this one? Well, I like the artwork here. But anybody recognize that name right there? Yeah, that's actually his son Monty. He's a editorial cartoonist for The Week. So many of us are familiar with that. Grew up with the books that his father illustrated in some kind of a pretty graphic way. For those that remember those Bible story books. But he makes a point here, Monty Wolverton is making a point, that we draw lines. That's what we as human beings do. And, I got an arrow there. And it's not just us and them. I mean, that's the title of the song. And, but it's not just us and them. It's actually us versus them. It's, we like to not just draw lines to separate. I'm not saying you individually, but as humans, we like to draw lines. But then we say, well, I'm this way, they're that way. It's us and them, and it's us against them, because we don't agree. We don't see things eye to eye. That's the way we are as people. It could be me and you. Could be us and them. Could be right and wrong. Of course, each when we have sides, they typically one side thinks it's right, one side thinks it's wrong, one side thinks it's right, one side thinks it's evil, you know, that the other side's evil. But the final one down here, self and other, that's the real human condition, isn't it? There's me and then there's everybody else that's not like me. And that just tends to be where we come from. And it has to do with self a lot. Self and other, you know, we'll draw a line there. Okay, now, this won't mean as much to you. I gave this down in the Baltimore area where there were at least one or two people in the congregation that remember this. December 25th, 1965, that was obviously Christmas, but it was also my first Sabbath at a Church of God Sabbath service. And it was at this building in downtown Baltimore that still stands, as far as I know, down on Cathedral Street. And it was called an Oddfellows Hall, fittingly enough. And we were up on the fourth floor where that now open sign is. And I was only 9 years old. And I can remember walking into that building, and there was an elevator that had an operator. You couldn't just push the button. You had to ask her, tell her what floor you're going to. And on Saturday, we were all going to the fourth floor. So we're all going to church. And you got in there, and I don't know if anybody remembers anybody named Bob Sloniker, but he was one of the first people you meet. He was like a greeter, big guy, single, middle-aged at the time. And, he'd shake your hand. I'm a little kid. He'd shake your hand off. And I can remember that. I can remember it like it's yesterday. I can't remember yesterday, but I can remember this like it's yesterday. I remember walking into that building. And this is where I started to think about, well, who am I? This isn't only. You have to figure these things out when you're young, right? Who am I? Where do I fit? And at 9 years old, and we've been doing different things for a while at home, but this is the first time I actually went to a service, on a Saturday, and this was part of what started thinking about who I am. How does this work? And part of my identity was being formed in this building every Saturday. And you've all gone through that. Some of us have grown up in our church culture, and we've gone through that as well. We have you might have added dimensions. Now, in my case, this is where I went to school. That school's not there anymore. The facade was there last time I was by. I was a flag safety. I got to get out. Me and another person would put the flags up and take them down. And this is another place where you're trying to figure out who you are in your school. And there's people around. And how do you fit in? And there's a country school way out in the boonies. But I can remember being at that school. I remember very well. I remember being the only one in the library, because the rest of the kids are doing something that I wasn't doing. Maybe some of you can relate to that. And I wasn't the only one trying to figure out who I was. That's what we do. What we do at that age. We have to know. So as I sat in church, though, you can't see it too well in this picture, but up on the fourth floor where the windows had the little arches in them, on very uncomfortable chairs. They were rather large, but they were uncomfortable, trust me. And there were hundreds of us in that building, finally probably about 400 or 500 before the Washington congregation started, and some of them went somewhere else. But I would hear the word Christians, okay? But when I would hear the word Christians at that age, it was usually accompanied with an adjective. And maybe you can relate to this. I'd hear so-called Christians, okay? I'd hear professing Christians. I'd hear true Christians, false Christians. Seems like there had to be an adjective with it for some reason. And I didn't realize it then so much, but, I was, where does this leave me? I'm starting to be exposed to the fact that this us and them culture that's part of the world was also part of my church culture. There was us and there was them. So who am I? How do I figure that out? Who am I? Or, should I ask, who am I not? And that's really what I want to talk about some today. Sometimes we don't identify, I can't speak for you, but sometimes we don't identify by who we are, but we identify by who we're not. Because we've identified who they are, the thems, and we're certainly not them, So who are we? We're not them. Does that make sense? A lot of us in our current society, we think that way because that's we're human. We draw lines. And I'm 9 years old trying to figure out, where do I draw this line between me and the other people? Or should I, do I need to draw a line? What does it even mean? Do you define yourself by who you are? Or do you define yourself by who you're not? The them in your life. You know, for those of us that have grown up or part of this culture, you know, we don't go to church on Sunday. All right? You're not from Maryland, but I am. And I don't eat crabs or shrimp or oysters or clams. And that's not allowed in Maryland. I'm kidding. But you know, my parents met in Baltimore. That's where I was born. And you go down the ocean, you eat crabs. No, we didn't go down the ocean and eat crabs. Didn't celebrate the traditional holidays that others around me. And you could just make a long list. You've been there. You understand. So, whether it was a church, at school, or maybe even just in my neighborhood. I grew up in the country. The first part of my childhood was in this house. That's a modern picture of that house. Very small, cinder block house, stucco on the outside. My parents had a $12,000 mortgage, as I recall. Zillow says it's worth $28,500. Maybe we should have hung on to it. I don't know. It's just a tiny little thing. But when we grew up there, it was poor. That area of Baltimore County is now full of big monsters' homes. And there were rich people there then, but not anywhere near where we were. But that part of the county got more and more money in it. So there I am, whether it's at home, school, church, trying to figure out who I am. That's me at about that age. And you notice I got something in my pocket. And Bob Sloniker, I can remember. I'll tell you, I can't remember yesterday. But I remember going into church, and I had a pen or something in my pocket. They didn't sew them shut back in those days. I had a pen there. And Bob Sloniker's like, you know, us men, we don't put it. He put it on the inside. You know, make me feel like I'm a big guy. Well, he was a big guy. Any of you, he ended up living in Florida. He's gone now. His wife died a few years ago. Anyway, he got married in his middle age. So who am I? I'm trying to figure out who I am. Who am I there at home? Who am I at school? How does that work? I'm trying to figure out my identity. In fact, I don't know. I have it in the notes here somewhere. Maybe I was already supposed to say it. But yeah, school. It wasn't confusing enough that I did these things differently. But then Mark and Lisa, said, you know, they were twins, and they came up one day and said, do you believe in Jesus? And I was like, oh, where's this coming from? Well, it turns out their father, let's get it straight, their mother was Jewish, their father was not. He was Christian. So they had both cultures. And they noticed I'm not at school on Feast of Trumpets, on Rosh Hashanah or whatever. I'm not at school. They noticed that. So they went, but some other reason, they weren't so sure I was Jewish. So they're trying to figure, now I wasn't the only person trying to figure me out. They were trying to figure me out. But I can remember that. That was fourth grade. It was right about the same time I was coming to church, 9 or 10 years old. Mark and Lisa asked me. So there I am, trying to figure out who I am. And if that wasn't enough, Aunt Lizzie lived in this house on Keswick Road down in Baltimore, not too far from Johns Hopkins where I went to school. But when I was a kid, occasionally my mom would work for my father's stepfather. It was all confusing. But she would go down like once a week and try to help. He was a salesman of sorts, and she would do his books in downtown Baltimore, near, not too far from where that church was. And Aunt Lizzie would watch my brother and I. And it's in a community called Hamden. I didn't realize it at the time, but Hamden was one of the most racially prejudiced communities in Baltimore. And we would play in the back alley. This is a picture of that actual alley. And her house was somewhere in here. And play kickball or whatever we're playing back there. And I remember the kid next door. Right, there were a bunch of kids there, but he was the closest one to us. And I don't know how it came up. I don't remember how it came up. But something I said, or something we were talking about, maybe it was talking about church or playing basketball, I don't know what I was talking about. And he looks at me and he says, "You're not a," and there's a word I can't say, "lover, are you?" I go, "Oh, that's the first time anything like that happened." But in this community, that was, I guess, to be expected. But I had a very good example from my parents. I grew up in a country where we didn't talk like that or need to even worry about it. And I went to an integrated church. We had lots of different people in the Baltimore congregation back in those days. So I'm still trying to figure out who I am, and I'm being thrown with this as well. Just a whole lot of things thrown at a kid. And some, I'm not saying I'm unique here, but I'm just relaying my story because you might be able to relate to it. And then I started to realize, you know, my country is not as unified as I thought it was, or as I wish it was. You know, and I've got a little graphic here. It's very much an us and them. Back in the 60s, still is. It was before that. Of course, I lived near Antietam Battlefield. Before the place I lived before that was near Gettysburg Battlefield. We had a lot of us and them long before I came along in our country. But again, the question is, who am I? Am I who I am or am I who I'm not? How about you? How do you identify yourself? Is having this us and them mentality a beneficial mindset, do you think? Is it good for you? Is it good to have that? Is it good for others if you have that? Here's the more important question. Does the Bible speak to this issue of us and them? And if it does, and it does, what does it say? What does it say? And how would that impact your life and my life today? Maybe not when I was 9, but how does it impact us today? So Brad's in charge of titles. Us and them, it's an easy one. Us and them. Our identity. Am I identified by who I am or by who I am not? Now, is us and them in the Bible? What do you think? Yes, no. Yeah, I mean, it's big time in the Bible. All right? And it all starts, I'd love to go to, you know this, if you've heard me speak, I'd love to go to Genesis and start. The serpent starts off, right? The serpent says, "Has God said, blah, blah, blah." Do we have us and them in the garden? And who is the us? We think. Who's the us in the garden? Adam and Eve and Satan. That's what I would say. Yeah. I'm sorry, I don't hear too. I love to be interactive, and I'm wearing hearing aids. It doesn't always work too well together. So.
I'm from the silent generation.
So yeah, you've got Adam and Eve and the devil. Now, who's them? Who's them? That's us. Us is Adam and Eve and the devil. Who's them? God. The devil's saying, "Hey, God's not giving you the straight scoop here. Let me help you out." All right. Us, and it starts in the very beginning. Adam and Eve, in fact, in chapter 3, verse 8, they heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day, and the man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord God among the trees of the garden. The fact that they had been talked into becoming part of an us that didn't include God made them feel separated from God, and they had to hide. Whether they did that literally or this, you know, whatever. But they felt separated. There was a line. There was an us and them line already, right in the beginning of the book. And it continues. Cain kills Abel. God's, you know, they're already kicked out of Eden. Now Cain gets kicked further out. And he complains. "You've driven me out from the face of the ground. From your face I'll be hidden. I'll be a vagrant and a wanderer. Whoever finds me will kill me." Like, you know, in a sense you think, well, did he have a right to complain at this point? But anyway, he did, and God was merciful. God says, "Hey, I'll protect you." So God put a mark on Cain to protect him. When it comes to us and them, this has got to be the classic, right? Who's us?
People in the ark.
What?
The people in the ark.
Yeah. And the animals, I guess, too, in a way, but yeah. You got eight us. Everybody else is a them. And God was part of this. So us and them, I'm not saying it's not in the Bible. It is. It is. There's only eight us, and whoever knows how many thems. I've shown you this picture before, that ziggurat at Ur. At the Tower of Babel, you know, in Deuteronomy 4, verse 19, and I've gone through this before, but Moses is warning the Israelites, don't lift up your eyes to heaven to see the sun, the moon, all the stars, the host of heaven, and be drawn away and worship them and serve them, those which the Lord your God has allotted to all the peoples under the whole heaven. So at this point, you get to Genesis 11, and God is saying, I'm done. I'm paraphrasing here. I'm done with you. I'm going to call my own people. You people can worship the sun, moon, and stars if you want. That's what you seem to want to do anyway. And then what's he do? So the point is here, God is doing the separating here. And not only is he doing the separating, but the next thing he does in the next chapter is call Abram and tell him to go leave his country, leave his relatives, leave his father's house, and go to a different land. Is that drawing a line? Kind of is, isn't it? Now, maybe Abraham was going to go anyway. There was a lot of migration at the time in that direction. There were wars and so on in Mesopotamia at the time. Maybe that's why his father had already moved out into the country, out to Haran. But anyway, God's saying, I want you to move away from these people that are part of, it's your us. God's telling him to move away from his us's and go to where they are, the thems, people he doesn't know. Although a lot of them were related distantly because there was a lot of migration at the time. So this is God's doing. God is separating. He's doing some separating. He does a lot of that in the Bible. Abraham said, go away from your country, away from your father's house, to the land I'll show you. So we have an us and a them. And this is God's doing. This is God's doing. God chooses an us, a new us. It's going to be his family, and they're going to be the children of Abraham. Not all the children of Abraham, but specifically the children of Isaac. They're going to be the new us. And what instructions does he give them? Well, when they are celebrating the first Passover, it says, this is the ordinance of the Passover. No foreigner is to eat of it. Okay, God's drawing a line between us and them. No foreigner can eat, but if a stranger sojourns with you and celebrates the Passover with the Lord, then all his males have to be circumcised. So he has to become one of you. You can't keep Passover, can't celebrate the Passover until you join us. And that's by God's decree. Okay? So God's very definitive here on how it's going to work. Why? Why? And we've been reading through Deuteronomy at home and homeschool, and there's a lot of us and them there. And so I've got to explain why to the grandchildren. So this has been on my mind lately. All right, Numbers 25, and you're familiar with these stories. I'm just reviewing this as we go through. Israel remained at Shittim, and the people began to play the harlot with the daughters of Moab. So they invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel joined themselves to Baal of Peor, and the Lord was angry against Israel. Why was God drawing these lines? Why all the commands as to how they were to behave when they got into the land, which were very us and them-ish? Well, it's right there. It's because God says he's a jealous God, right? You only worship me. You don't worship other gods. I'm not just one of the gods. I'm not even just the best God. I'm the only God. I'm Yahweh. You worship me. You don't worship all the other ones. I don't know that Israel ever got that to that point. You know, archaeologists dig up all kinds of gods when they dig up Israelite settlements from the old days. But God was behind this us and them approach because it had a purpose. Just to keep his people worshiping him because he knew how they were. Moses did too. It had to do with worship. Who will you worship? Okay? Deuteronomy is full of this. No Ammonite. This is, we just read this this week. In fact, it was Friday. with the kids. No Ammonite or Moabite shall enter into the assembly of the Lord, none of their descendants. This is Moses saying. Because they didn't meet you with food and water on the way out when you came out of Egypt, that because they hired against you Balaam, the son of Peor, from Pethor of Mesopotamia, to curse you. You shall never seek their peace or their prosperity all of your days. That's what Moses instructed the people as they were going into the land. Don't seek good relationships with these people. They are them, and they're going to stay them. That's what he says. Now, we know, even from the Hebrew scriptures, that there were exceptions to this. You know, Ruth being the major one, right? Moabite first generation. And she joins and gets into the kingly line of David and then Jesus. So it shows that, you know, God in the end, God works these things out however he wants to. But humanly speaking, and even with God's support in a way, he's like, no, we want to have this us and them divider. Because I don't want you worshiping the sun, moon, and stars and all the other gods. I don't want you worshiping them. And if I don't draw a line between you and your neighbors, you're going to do that. And they did it anyway, of course. Deuteronomy 6, verses 10 to 15. It shall come about when the Lord your God brings you into the land. Watch yourself that you don't forget the Lord who brought you from the land of Egypt out of the house of slavery. You shall fear only the Lord your God. And you shall worship him and swear by his name. You shall not follow other gods, any of the gods of the people who are around you. For the Lord your God is in the midst of you. He's a jealous God. Not jealous for human jealousy. He's jealous, as I spoke to this one congregation, and I asked people to define what jealous was. And the gentleman said, well, how did he put it? He put it better than I would have thought of it. I can't remember the verb he used, though. But, you know, no competition. All right? I'm not going to share my God saying, I'm God, I'm Yahweh, I'm your God. And I'm not going to share that with anybody else. All right? So that's the reason. That's the reason for the us and them. God makes it clear in Scripture. Moses makes it clear over and over and over again in Deuteronomy. This is the reason for it. And the warnings... This is, you know, Moses starts. He says, if you do go after other gods, you're going to perish. You know, you're going to pay for it. It's not going to work out for you. And then we get to Jeremiah, okay? We're going to get to the prophets. And Jeremiah is saying, you know, 23 years, the word of the Lord's come to me, and I've spoken to you again and again, but you haven't listened. The Lord has sent to you all his servants and prophets over and over again. You still haven't listened. Don't go after other gods and serve them and worship them. But because you have not obeyed my words, I'll send to you Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant. Now, Nebuchadnezzar's going to do what I need to have done here. And you're going to pay because you followed other gods. So when we get to the prophets, they say these kinds of things. Because Israel didn't keep itself pure. But what's interesting about the prophets is that the prophets say some other things too. As we make our way through the Hebrew scriptures, look at some of this here. I've only got a couple of verses. Isaiah 49, verse 6. Is it too small a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to restore the preserved ones of Israel? Okay, we're talking about Messiah here, right? I will also make you a light to the nations. What's the nations? That's the word for everybody that's not Israel. It's Gentiles. So that my salvation may reach to the ends of the earth. So here's Isaiah prophesying a time when we're going to blur that line between us and them. And the thems are going to come and worship with us. And the Jews of Jesus' day knew how this was going to work. They believed this. They go back to Exodus 12 and say, yeah, everybody's got to become Jewish. That's how it's going to work. They got it right from their scriptures. So that's what they think. That's what they figured. Now, you remember Simeon. He was he was an older fellow by that time, served in the temple. And God had promised him that he would get to see Messiah. And he says in Luke 2, for my eyes have seen your salvation, which you have prepared in the presence of all peoples, a light of revelation to the Gentiles. So he understood, he was inspired to say, that Messiah was going to be a light to the Gentiles also. We're blurring that line between us and them. And the glory of your people Israel. Israel's still part of it, but we're going to include the Gentiles now. So the prophet saw that. Simeon sees that. So how's us and them going to work now? Let's look at Jesus. Here you have the temple. Model of it. And Jesus had driven out the money changers. You had all kinds of commercial stuff going on out here in the outer courts and out here in the porch areas. Yeah, okay, they had you know, selling things and so forth. Not only that, you had the money changers. So he threw the money changers out because they were ripping the people off. You had to use the temple shekel or whatever it was, and you had to buy, you know, they had the perfect sacrifices, so you had to buy from them. So it was a big business for the Sadducees and everybody that was involved with them. So Jesus says, this is Mark chapter 11, and he's quoting Isaiah. He began to teach and say to them, isn't it written, my house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations? Okay, that's the ethnos, that's the Gentiles, it's everybody. But you have made it a robber's den. So that's his justification for throwing out the money changers. But he quotes Isaiah and says, it's for everybody. It's not just for the us. It's not just for the Jews that living in Judea or that are making a pilgrimage to come there. He quotes Isaiah. So what did Jesus say, and how did he model behavior? What did he model? What was the example he set for his disciples? And we're his disciples. So what example did he set? Well, it's a little different than what you read in Deuteronomy. Why? Well, it's a different time, different, you know, the different reasons. We're not talking about a nation settling in the land. In Matthew 5, verse 43 and 44, you have heard that it said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Well, the Torah doesn't exactly say those words. But it did say, don't seek the good of any Moabite, Ammonite or Moabite, because they didn't help you. Now, it didn't say hate them, but it said don't do anything good for them. So that's pretty close, isn't it? But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. We don't read that in Deuteronomy either. So Jesus is saying, all right, yeah, there's us and them. I think, and I'm going to teach you, to pray for them. Pray for them. And love them. That's different than what Moses was telling Israel as they were entering the land. Because it's a different reason, different time. You know, Deuteronomy, don't seek their peace. Don't do anything good for them. And Jesus says, love them and pray for them. All right? Different time, different reasons. Matthew 11. He's upbraiding, is the way I think some of the commentators say it, the cities around. We're up there around the Galilee. And he's denouncing them because he had done miracles there and the people weren't believing. They didn't repent. So back to Capernaum, I could go through a bunch of them, but just Capernaum in particular. He says to them, I'll say to you, it'll be more tolerable for the land of Sodom in the day of judgment than for you. Whoa. You know, if you could pick a society from the Hebrew scriptures that was a them, you might pick Babylon. But maybe second, at least, would be Sodom. Maybe Sodom would be first. Right? That's a them for sure. But somehow it's going to be more tolerable for them than for the people that were in the cities around the Sea of Galilee where Jesus preached and did his miracles. How does that work? How can it be more tolerable for them than for the us? I mean, we are God's people. I'm saying we. I'm talking about the Jews at Jesus' time. But we can say the same thing. A lawyer came up to Jesus. You know, somebody not a lawyer in court, but a lawyer, somebody who really studied the law, understood the Torah. And he's testing Jesus. He says, teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus, who loved to answer questions with a question, said, well, what's written in the law? You're a lawyer. Tell me what it says. He said, well, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and all your strength, and with all your mind. And love your neighbor as yourself. And what did Jesus say? What did he say? Jesus said, hey, you're right. You've answered correctly. Do this and you'll live. Then what's the guy ask? Well, who's my neighbor? Who is this group of people that I have to love as myself? He wants to qualify it. How does Jesus answer this question? Remember? Who is my neighbor? How does he answer that one? The whole parable, right? What? The parable of the Good Samaritan? The parable of the Good Samaritan. The Samaritans in Jesus' time were others. They were thems. You remember the history? I think I have a map here. Yes, I do. So Jesus goes into the Good Samaritan. Now, the Galilee's up here. That's where Jesus' preaching was most of the time. He'd come down to Jericho, he'd come down to Jerusalem, and Mary and Lazarus, different ones were down here. But he was from up here. If you are a really, really righteous Jew, you wouldn't go from the Galilee to Judea by walking through Samaria. You could. It'd be shorter. Some people actually would cross, and this wasn't a good area either. These were mostly, they weren't Jewish, they were pagans. So, but at least they weren't pretending to be Jewish. The Samaritans kind of, pretend to be the same religion. So some people would come actually around, down, and then back up from Jericho to Jerusalem. Jesus didn't. He went right through Samaria. He didn't have a problem with that. But people looked down at the Samaritans. You remember where the Samaritans came from, right? That's people that lived there, plus Assyria moved some outsiders down, people from Assyria come down. Assyria wasn't satisfied just to conquer people. They would deport people that lived there. They'd bring their own in, try to make sure there was just no chance of any kind of rebellion once they controlled an area militarily. So the Samaritans were looked down on by the Jews as being fakes, imposters. Even though they kind of had their understanding of the Torah and so forth, and looked at Abraham as their father and all of that. So there's when Jesus decided to make a parable about the Good Samaritan, that was like poking right in that guy's eye, right? Like, oh well, and the guy had to admit that the Samaritan was a good guy here. Jesus didn't stop there. Can you remember any other examples of Jesus interacting with Samaritans or using Samaritans as an example? Anybody?
The woman at the well.
The woman at the well. She was a Samaritan, right? And there's a couple things with that. She's a Samaritan, but she's also a woman. Like, there's a good Jew, Jesus, he's gonna walk over there and strike up a conversation with this woman at a well, which is bad enough. Plus, she's had all these husbands, and that's bad enough. And she's a Samaritan to boot. And I will apologize to the disciples when I see them if this is incorrect, but I can just imagine them really rolling their eyes. Or here's Jesus again. Look who he's talking to. He was modeling things for them, but they didn't always get it. He talks to the Samaritan woman. How about James and John? I've talked about this before. James and John in Luke chapter 9. Remember, Jesus was headed to Jerusalem. But he sent some people out ahead to, I don't know what, to make arrangements, to grease the wheels on the way through or whatever as they go through Samaria. But the Samaritans weren't very welcoming. Remember why? Because they knew he was going to Jerusalem. He wasn't coming to see them at that time. He was headed to Jerusalem, so they weren't very friendly. And what did James and John suggest to deal with their lack of friendliness? Lightning from heaven, right? So, yeah, we'll take care of them. Why? Because they're others. They're thems. They deserve it. And Jesus, what did Jesus say? Remember what he said? You don't know what mind you have. You don't know what mind you're of. So, Jesus is modeling for them being his disciples, that this line that they have in their minds between us and them is really not a valid line, at least not now, not anymore. Now, how about the leper? It says a leper came to him and bowed down before him and said, Lord, if you're willing, you can make me clean. Anybody can remember what lepers had to do back in those days? When they're walking down the street?
Cross over the street.
Well, they probably had to move, but what else did they have to do? They had to tell. They didn't just tell, right? They were supposed to yell something. I don't know what it would be in Aramaic or something. But they had to yell something. I'm a leper. Because why? Because anybody else would become unclean by being in contact or even close to him, maybe. I don't know. They definitely wouldn't contact him. Because then they couldn't go to the temple or they couldn't do whatever. Maybe they couldn't even eat until they had the right washings, mikvah. I don't know. But that's why they had to announce their arrival. And they said they understood that Jesus could make him well. And what's it say? It's Jesus stretched out his hand and touched them. Touched him. Not only did he not draw a line and distance himself, he touched him. Nobody would do that. But Jesus did. I'm willing, be cleansed. And immediately his leprosy was cleansed. Jesus, over and over again, we don't know how many times, we only know what's recorded for us in the Gospels. But Jesus, over and over again in the Gospels, is showing his disciples and anybody else who's paying any attention that the old lines of us and them don't apply anymore. At the time of Jesus, if you lived in Judea, and you had a Roman governor, who in your community could you imagine would be the ultimate them? And I don't think it would be the governor. Could be, but the governor wasn't as oppressive appearing as maybe others might be. Who would be the one that would just, you know, if you were Jewish?
A Roman soldier.
Now, I'm not there, you know, but I'm just guessing. I think if you were under occupation, okay, like Maryland was where I lived during the Civil War, you all were good, loyal unionists. In Maryland, we had, out where I live now, they were kind of unionists, but further toward the Baltimore and over in the Eastern Shore, they just assumed would have joined the Confederacy, but that would have surrounded Washington, so we can't let that happen. So when you're occupied, as Maryland was during the war, you don't really like the people that are occupying you. Baltimore, if you know your history, from there, so I do. Baltimore rioted against the Union troops when they came through. All right. So if you're occupied, you're not happy about that. Jesus entered Capernaum, and a centurion, not just any soldier, but somebody who was a boss soldier, a centurion came to him, imploring him and saying, "Lord, my servant is lying paralyzed at home, fearfully tormented." And Jesus said to him, "I'll come and heal him." Jesus is going to come or go and heal a them? Now, it turns out he didn't have to go because centurion understood faith and said, you know, he make a command and it happened. So, but Jesus is really blurring the lines here or eliminating the lines between us and them. If that wasn't bad enough, I showed you, I was pointing at the Decapolis where people would come around. If you look at this map here, you got the Sea of Galilee. And it was that time that Jesus fell asleep. You know, I think he was, as I told you before, I think he was asleep on purpose. And all these tough fishermen, as well as the other disciples on the boat, they're scared to death. They think they're going to die. They wake him up. And he tells the sea to be calm. And it was. And then they realize, you know, this isn't just a normal rabbi here. We got somebody that's really special. He can tell the ocean and the weather what to do. All right, so after that, while they're still in the water, they went to the other side to the Gadarene. So they're coming over here. And this is the Decapolis. This is an area that's not Jewish. All right? And obviously, right? Because remember the herd of pigs where the demons went. So two men who were demon-possessed met him as they were coming out of the tombs. They hung out of the tombs. And they were so extremely violent that no one could pass that way. So this is a non-Jewish side of the lake. And not only that, we got these demon-possessed people that come that Jesus interacts with. And it doesn't say, I think I've mentioned this before, but I can't prove this one way or the other. It doesn't say that the disciples got out of the boat. This might have been just too much for them. Jesus got out and did some things. It doesn't say anything at all about the disciples being with him. My hunch is that they said, we'll take care of the boat, Jesus. You go out. You go on. Oh, well, anyway. So Jesus comes here. He comes here. Not just Samaria, but he goes over to the Gadarenes. All right. Jesus is reclining at the table at the house, and there were many tax collectors and sinners. Now, for some reason, Matthew decided that, because he was a tax collector, right? So he says tax collectors and sinners. Probably if somebody else would have written this, they would just lump them all together. People didn't like the tax collectors because they cheated people, some of them. Maybe even Matthew wasn't that way when he did it. They were dining with Jesus and his disciples. And when the Pharisees saw this, they said to his disciples, why is your teacher eating with the tax collectors and the sinners? Now, I have given this message before in the presence of a tax collector, an IRS agent. And actually, it was a former IRS agent in the room. He was good-natured about it. It was okay. And another congregation where there is an actual current IRS agent, but she wasn't there the week I gave it. Yeah, but it's different. Our people, at least, are supposed to obey the law. In Rome, they got paid by ripping off the people. They were allowed to take something, to take more tax than what was owed because they had to be paid. But some of them abused that privilege, and that's one of the reasons they were hated so much, and also because they seemed to be collaborating with the Romans. So here you have Jesus eating with tax collectors and sinners, if there's any difference between them. And remember how Jesus answered that one? They said, wait, yeah, why are you eating with tax collectors and sinners? Remember what Jesus said? He said, he said, isn't it those who are sick that need a physician, not those who are healthy? If you're sick or you have some kind of emergency, your heart's racing or your heart's doing something and your arm starts to hurt and, you call 911. You want to see people that look like this. You want to see people maybe with masks on, maybe with scrubs on, maybe with a stethoscope around their neck and hope that they know something more than you know about this and they can help you. And Jesus is saying, I'm here to be one of these people to help those that are sick. I can't help them if I avoid them. It's not those who are healthy that need a physician, but those who are sick. He says, go and learn what this means. I desire compassion and not sacrifice. I didn't come to call the righteous, but sinners. Now, you could say, if you want to debate this, you could say, well, Jesus told him, don't go to this Gentiles. And he did. It wasn't time yet. He did. Matthew 10, verses 5 and 6. Don't go in the way of the Gentiles. When he sent out the disciples sometime, he sent out 70. Don't enter into any city of the Samaritans. Now, Jesus did. He was modeling for them what they needed to know, but it wasn't time for them to do that. They were supposed to go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. But later on, of course, he called somebody whose job was to go to those other people. So they weren't yet sent to the Gentiles, but there's an important person who was, okay? Jesus told Paul, Paul's relaying this to Felix or whoever it was at this particular time. He says that, when he was struck down on the road to Damascus, he hears this voice that says, go, I will send you far away to the Gentiles. I'll send you far away. Your job is going to be to go to the Gentiles. So God calls a special person to do this, to go to the thems. To go to the thems. In Galatians 2, verse 9, James, Cephas, and John gave to me and Barnabas. So, Paul's saying, I got approval from the guys at Jerusalem. Gave to me and Barnabas the right hand of fellowship that we might go to the Gentiles and they to the circumcised. So now the time had come to spread the gospel beyond what was them in what we call the Old Testament. To spread the gospel to the thems. So how does this work? Why is it different, and how can it be different? What's the big difference, for one? What's the big difference between Moses instructing Israelites before they go into the land. And Jesus and Paul, or Jesus teaching his disciples, and Paul and Jesus and Paul both modeling a ministry to Gentiles that are not us, if you're speaking from a Jewish perspective. What's the big difference between the time of Deuteronomy and the time of Jesus? Or the time after Jesus, put it that way. What happened that was it made things entirely different?
Jesus came.
Jesus came, and then when he went back to his Father, what happened? Holy Spirit. The Israelites didn't have the Holy Spirit. Not in general, not that the Spirit didn't work with them. It says, you know, it helped the guys that built the tabernacle and all that. But in general, they didn't have a Spirit. After Jesus went back to his Father, the Spirit came. So it's a very different time now. It's a different time. Jesus said, oh, I forgot to animate this. Jesus said, you are the salt of the earth. Now just stop right there. We have lots of great messages over the years. I've heard them, you've heard them, about salt. And how salt is a preservative, and salt does this, salt does that. That's all good. But what I've never heard, or if I did, it just went in one ear and out the other. How do we use salt? Not just what does it do, but how do we use it? Sparingly, maybe, but, I mean, in what way do we, now I'm giving you a hint here because, you know, I got two pictures. We sprinkle it. I do, anyway. I don't sprinkle too much because I'm high blood pressure, you know. But anyway, that's what we do, right? It gets spread around whatever we're eating. Jesus, when he said you're the salt of the earth, I picture it more like this than like this. But Israel, when you think about it, Israel was a salt lick, wasn't it? What did God tell them? We had all these laws, right? And Moses, I think, says it in Deuteronomy too. But it's like, what was the impression that the Israelites were to give to the nations around them? Well, look at the blessings they have. They have a law that's making this happen. It was supposed to be a way that other people, the thems, could see, hey, they're on to something because look at all their blessings. But Israel was a salt lick because they were confined to one place. But now, not just now, for the last 2,000 years, God's had a different system. He says, you're a salt sprinkled around because you have me living in you. I don't have to put you all in one place. You don't have to. We haven't been called to be in a commune. I don't know how we'd get along, how well, but you know, it's not about saying communes are necessarily bad, but that's not what we're told in Scripture, right? We're not supposed to just all decide we're going to go up the. So what's the place near you?
Cloisters.
Yeah, the cloisters. We're not. That's not what we're called to do. I'm not criticizing people who do that, but that's not what the Christians in general are called to do. To be a salt lick that people can look at and say, hey, they're onto something. No, Jesus has decided we're going to get out there just like the disciples and be in the middle of all of it. And we have the ability, if you want to put it that way, to do it because God's living in us. You know, Jesus is living in us through the Spirit, which wasn't the case before. So I think if the analogy works, I think Israel was more of a salt lick where we're salt sprinkled around. We're all over the place. And we live, just like, as I found out as a 9-year-old, whether it's my school or my home or my church, wherever I am, I interact with a lot of people. We're in the alley out back behind my Aunt Lizzie's. I'm in places that maybe I'm not even crazy about being there, but that's God's will that I'm there to be an example to whoever it is that's next door. Even if I don't know what I'm doing at 9 years old, I'm still an example. God can use us, and he does. So we're spread around to a world that, you know, in the analogy here, is not salted yet. It's being salted by Christians. That's what our calling is. So why is it different? Well, because we have the Spirit. But now in Christ Jesus, you who were formerly were far off, brought near by the blood of Christ. For he himself is our peace, which made both groups into one and broke down the barrier of the dividing wall. Now, what's the barrier of the dividing wall? You might have your idea. You look at a commentary, someone will say, well, this is symbolic. You know, we're here next week, Atonement, we'll talk about this maybe, depending on where you are. You know, that the curtain was ripped. Or some people would say, hey, it's this thing, this stone that we have. I mean, there were lots of them, but this was a sign in the temple court that told Gentiles, this is where you stop. You go any further, you're responsible for your own death because we're going to kill you. You know, you don't get to go into the temple of the Israelites, or the court of the Israelites. Ephesians 2. I'm breaking into a thought, but Paul's talking about abolishing, I guess you just read this probably last week, abolishing in his flesh the enmity, which is the law of commandments contained in ordinances, so that in himself he might make the two into one new man, thus establishing peace, and might reconcile them both in one body to God through the cross, by it having put to death the enmity. Some kind of thing that separates. Just like we draw the line, like in that editorial cartoon by Monty Wolverton. We draw lines and we have an enmity. We have some kind of a conflict between the us and the them. And Paul, writing to the Ephesians, says, God's in the process of erasing that line. Erasing that line. And putting to death the enmity. And that's what we're to be involved in. The rules, like in Deuteronomy and plenty of other ones, that drew lines between Israel and the nations. That, you know, God did that. I'm not, you know, it's not a wrong thing. It's what was necessary at the time, but that's not the situation we're in now. I already covered this. What makes it possible? It's the Holy Spirit. Christ lives in me, right? John 17. You might think you'd like it to be different. I might like it to be different. I don't ask... Jesus said to his Father, I don't ask you to take them out of the world, but to keep them from the evil one. They are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. Sanctify them in the truth. Your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, I have also have sent them into the world. You've been sent into the world. I've been sent into the world. You can love it or not love it, but you know, that's the reality. I didn't understand that as much when I was 9 as I do now, but that's my job. It's not my job to be in a cloister somewhere. It's my job to be like salt spread out, and it's your job too. And God makes that possible. You know, Jesus lives in us through the Spirit. So Paul's commission, it was to the others. It was to them. And he told them, you know, you don't have to become us. You don't have to, become circumcised, you know, like we understood from Exodus 12 and other places that, you know, you don't have to become Jewish to be Christian, okay? God has created a new us in these times. And Jesus has already modeled it for his disciples. And it took them a while to get it because they're fighting about it in Acts. I'm not saying that, the 12 necessarily, but they have a big conference about it. And even after they had the conference, they're still having a problem because Paul's preaching and people are chasing him from city to city. It's like, you know what he's doing? He's telling, spreading rumors about him. But you know what? It took them a while. And I'm not saying that to be critical. I'm saying maybe sometimes in order to change a mindset, it takes a while. I'm guessing. That I got rid of here. Paul 3 years. It says Paul spent 3 years in Arabia. It doesn't say doing what. But you know, Paul was a Pharisee. Paul was sending Christians to their death. Maybe it took him 3 years to rework his thinking. Maybe it took him some of that time. As he's going back through all these scriptures that he knows by heart. And he's saying, all right, I just had, saw Jesus on the way to Damascus, and he says this. How does that work with the scriptures I already understand? And it took him more than a day or two to figure that out, I'm sure. Maybe a lot of days. And it could be the same with us. Sometimes because we're in an us and them mentality, it doesn't disappear overnight. But I don't think it's godly, not for this time. I don't think that's what he wants. So we could be in the same boat, maybe, because, well, I know this verse and I know that verse, but, you know, but it's a different time. It's a different time. And maybe, just maybe, there's times when I'm afraid to get out of the boat. Like maybe the disciples were afraid to get out of the boat. I don't know. So who am I? Did I form an identity based on who I wasn't rather than who I was? And the answer to that is yes. That's what I did. I formed an identity on being different as a young person, for better or for worse. You know me, how I turned out, but it wasn't the identity that Jesus modeled for us. And to change that mentality has been a process for me, and it doesn't happen overnight. So, let me see what time. Okay, I got to wrap up. I'm not going to read all of Matthew 25 at the end there, but I'll just briefly mention that it talks about sheep and goats, right? You know, am I somebody? Who am I? Am I who I am, or am I who I'm not? And I could, if I look in Matthew 25, say, all right, you got sheep and you got goats, and well, I'm not a goat. That's not, I don't think that's what God wants. I don't think he wants that. You know, am I giving something to drink to somebody who's thirsty? Am I feeding the hungry? Am I clothing the people without clothing? No, am I serving in the way Jesus says to serve? And is that my identity? Well, that's how we serve Christ. That's what he says. So I would have read through the whole thing, but I'm out of time. What do you do? You know, we could say, oh, when did I see you hungry? Lord, when did I see you thirsty? When did I see you in prison? When did I see you sick? And Jesus said, well, when you did it to the least of your brethren, you did it to me. So us and them. In the end, it really is us and them. It really is. Because there's sheep and there's goats. And the question is, are you a sheep or are you a goat? Am I a sheep or am I a goat? And after all these years, maybe before all these years, but especially now, I don't identify myself by who I'm not. I've decided, you know who I know who I am. I'm a sheep, and that's my identity. I'm identified by who I am, not by who I'm not. And you are too.